Well, welcome to another episode of Legends Among Us, a podcast devoted to the troopers and veterans of 3rd Cavalry Regiment. My name is Chaplain Jason Phipps. I'm the regimental chaplain, and I thought last episode was going to be my last episode, but alas, we are in the middle of Ray Rifles Week, and I am still here. So very excited, however, this week to have a true legend among us. We have with us today the 70th commander of the regiment, Colonel David Teeples. Sir, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here. It's a great pleasure to be back in the Cav country and especially talking with you today.
Thank you, sir. So I remember the last time I met you was last Brave Rifles Week. I think you spoke at the alumni dinner that we had at Lone Star Conference Center. And then you also spoke at the memorial rededication that we did at our memorial over by Old Post Chapel. But I'm assuming you have been coming to Brave Rifles Week celebrations for years now.
Yes.
Before we get into the details of that, tell me a little bit about what life has been like since retirement. We'll probably go back a little bit further. I want to hear about your time coming into the Army. I understand you were at West Point at one point in time, but
I'll tell you the long version. First of all, I have to let everyone know that I'm a product of my family. My dad was a World War II veteran, an infantryman. He enlisted in the Wisconsin Army National Guard in 1939, and they were federalized in 1940. And then he spent the next 6 years actually serving. He became a scout, an Alamo scout. When he was in Australia, there was a kind of a volunteer thing, signed up to be an Alamo scout, which was a 6th Army reconnaissance unit. So he was transferred to the training site. This is the precursor to Merrill's Marauders.
Oh, wow.
And in, okay. In 1995, the Alamo Scouts were recognized as a special forces unit, and any former members of the Alamo Scouts were authorized to wear the Green Beret. My dad was an Alamo Scout, earned the Silver Star, and he had a combat infantryman's badge, which was his most prized honor or citation, was the CIB. So there were 4 boys. I have 3 brothers. All of us grew up wearing old fatigues, playing Army, and wanting to be an infantryman, just like our dad. My 2 older brothers both enlisted out of high school, went to Vietnam, and they were infantrymen. The older brother, not so much to talk about, but the other older brother, Tom, volunteered to be a LRP, long-range reconnaissance patrol, for the 4th Infantry Division. And that's what he did for a year in Vietnam. And then when he came back a few years after he had been back, he joined the National Guard. He served and retired as an E-7 in the Wisconsin Army National Guard. My younger brother also enlisted out of high school in the Wisconsin Army National Guard, served for 20 years and retired as an E-7 infantryman. So all of this is kind of a backdrop to when I was about ready to graduate from high school in 1970. I graduated in 1971, but in 1970, my 2 older brothers had been serving, and one of them was still in Vietnam. All I wanted to do was graduate from high school and get into the Army and serve my country. So, but my dad had other plans for me. I had some skill playing football, and he said, why don't you apply to West Point? And that way you can be in the Army, you can get a college education, and you can play some football. And so I did that, I got a nomination to go to West Point. So in 1971, when I graduated from high school, the first day that I was at West Point, the 1st of July, 1971, was the first time I said the oath. And that has been one of the most important things in my entire career, was that oath of office. So I played football. Freshman at that time, freshmen could not play on varsity, but I started on the freshman team. And then in the second year, I received a pretty severe knee injury. I was hospitalized for a month or so, and they did some surgery on the knee. And then it was better, but it wasn't better. And I missed a lot of classes that first semester. I failed differential equations. And then I came back in the second semester and I got a infection in the knee, and they had to put me in the hospital again. And I missed a bunch of school. I wasn't really into studying in the hospital. I failed physics. So I got turned back. I would have been with a class of 75, but instead I left West Point in 1973, and I went to a small state school and I got a secondary education degree, and I taught, ironically, mathematics. And I was able to coach football and basketball and even baseball one season at a small school in Wisconsin. I also, in 1975, was married that summer, and I enlisted in the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Now, the city that I was enlisted in was an engineer detachment. So I was a combat engineer for a while. And then they suggested I go to the Wisconsin Military Academy, a state OCS program, basically. That was 1978. And at that time, we had also moved from the city I was teaching in to another city. And that city had an armor battalion. Yeah. So if you're not familiar with the National Guard, if you get commissioned, it's commissioned in the type of unit that you're serving. Mm-hmm. And so I was serving in an armor battalion in that city. Mm-hmm. And so I was commissioned a second lieutenant of armor. And then in 1981, I requested active duty status. So the National Guard Bureau put me on active duty. My first duty assignment was at Fort Riley, Kansas. And that's where I started my 30-year career on active duty. So 36 years total, but that's the beginning kind of story, which was fairly unusual for that time.
So previous podcast I did, I interviewed Sergeant Major Dennis Webster, and also from Wisconsin. He had mentioned that there are some similarities and there's some differences. Yeah, obviously, he served during a different era. You served during a different era, but you also, your service went into the GWAT era, an era that many service members are still connected to that are on active duty. But there was just some differences that you experienced growing up in the active component during the 80s and the 90s. I know my dad was of the Vietnam era. He experienced a RIF in the late 70s going into the 80s. It was an era of peacetime, more or less. Would you please just share some of the differences from your foxhole, sir? Differences that perhaps existed during the 80s and 90s, particularly in the armored community as compared to now?
The beginning of the 80s, when I went on active duty to Fort Riley, Kansas, I went to a tank battalion, 163 Armored Tank Battalion. It was the old structure, 4 platoon tank company and a maintenance platoon. And it was M60 A1 rise passive. And so the 1st Infantry Division at that time was not a go-to-war kind of, I mean, we trained for going to war, but realistically, we didn't have the equipment. But as the 80s progressed, there was big buildup, modernization effort, a training effort. In the 80s was the beginning of the National Training Center. I made a rotation of the NTC out of Riley as a platoon leader, and then as a company commander, a tank company commander. And the experiences that I learned in those first two rotations, the NTC, were so revealing about how an armor organization should operate in a desert environment.
And this was also during the Cold War era as well. So perhaps a different mindset versus when we surged forces during Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and then going into GWAT. But I think I'm wondering if there's some similarities now to those years, particularly in the early 80s when armor units were perhaps planning tactically to fight a near-peer threat, in this case, the Russians, versus how we perceive near-peer threats now in the modern era, if there's some similarities with regards to just that average trooper, that average infantry, cavalryman, versus what we have now. I'm not sure if you have some thoughts since you were there during that time.
One of the things that I really wanted to do was to get into an armored cavalry regiment. I had been a scout platoon leader in 163 armor, and I liked the idea of being able to provide information for the rest of the force. And this is something that modernization has actually increased the ability for us to paint the battlefield for the force. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what scouts do, what cavalry has provided. And now we've got fantastic tools. But in that time period, we were just transitioning to the M1, the Bradley, 155 howitzer. So all those things were, and the aircraft. The first time I went to the NTC as a squadron commander, we still had Cobras. And we had OH-58s, but they weren't Delta model. And so Air Cav scout team that has a Apache behind it makes a world of difference in mounted maneuver.
So you were really on the cusp of the Big Five, which I know they developed in the mid to late 70s, like when they were actually fielding the Apaches and Blackhawks and Bradleys. So you got to experience all that.
But at Riley, they didn't have any of that stuff.
Yet. Oh, wow. So okay.
I left Riley in 85. My next operational unit was the 11th ACR in Fulton.
And I wanted to ask you about 11th ACR as well, because my experience with 11th ACR is NTC, Black Horse, and they are Op 4. But I know that they have played some more perhaps significant roles in our nation's history with regards to providing frontline defense. So what was your experience with them?
My experience completely prepared me for the rest of my career when I served in the 11th ACR. And here's why. The commander of the 11th ACR was William Wallace. William Scott Wallace.
Okay.
And
still a pretty awesome name to have for a commander.
It is. I'll tell you about my movement with him. And it's funny because most people remember him when he took command of the 4th Infantry Division here at Fort Hood. He said, the first time that I ever served in a division was when I commanded it. He had been in cavalry his whole life, ACRs, 2nd, 11th. So when I got stationed as a Squadron 3 in 1992 in Fulda, Wallace had just taken command of the 11th ACR. And then in 93, I became his regimental operations officer, Regimental 3. So I learned from the master of Armored Cavalry Regiment operations. That was Scott Wallace. We spent so much time together, and we had Bradleys. We still had Cobras. No, we had OHs then. That's right. We had 58s. We didn't have Apaches yet though, there. But the Hohenfels rotation that we did was for a regimental 3 to have a mentor who is an Armored Cavalry Regiment guru. Scott Wallace, I learned so much about an ACR. We talked about covering force and all the core operations that you do. But one of the biggest things was, what does an armored cavalry regiment, it has three missions. It's security, reconnaissance, and economy of force. Mm. How do you use an ACR in an economy of force mission? So hold that thought. So then I leave the ACR in 94. That's when the Black Horse folded the flags. We shut down Downs Barracks, folded the flag, and it went to Irwin.
Okay.
It became basically a training battalion, Still with the 11th ACR, but it's now a tank battalion and an infantry battalion. That was my 11th ACR story. Now, after Washington, I get to take command of 2nd Squadron, 3rd ACR, Dempsey. Is the 67th commander. Mike Bills was my squadron XL. So those names in the 3rd ACR are extremely meaningful. And so I was mentored and supported, and I grew a great deal as a commander under Dempsey. Then after squadron command, Wallace, who is now the 4th Infantry Division commander, calls me down to be his G3. So now I receive more mentoring from Wallace at the division level, and how divisions see ACRs and in relationship to Corps command, and how the Corps uses the ACR with divisions. We did the first digital TAC at the NTC rotation. So that was the beginning of the digital age. So then I went to school and got 3rd ACR as 70th Colonel, and what an honor. Now, this is 2002, so we're at war. So in the summer of 2002, when I took command, we had an NTC rotation planned for August. But we were on the tip of it to be the lead in the invasion of Iraq. During that summer, in preparation for the NTC rotation, I was taking my first squadron, Bill Dolan, and the aviation squadron, which now we had Apaches, OH-58 Deltas. Here's the situation in the Corps position. I Corps, which was in Fort Lewis, was going to do a warfighter. They wanted an ACR. Now, the 3rd Cav is the only ACR. Remember, the 11th is now as a training battalion. The 2nd is 2nd ACR Light at Fort Lewis and then moved to Fort Polk. So in actuality, there's only one armored cavalry regiment in the Army. Everybody wanted it. I sent Butch Kiebenauer up to I Corps, and he played the regiment for them. 3rd Corps, which the regiment was the eyes and ears of 3rd Corps for many years, a 2nd Squadron went down to 3rd Corps because we were in preparation to move out to the NTC. And I took 1st Squadron, Aviation Squadron, and the Support Squadron. And even there, we were, Force Comm Commander Ellis at the time, came out to the NTC to look at us and said, you know, these OH-58s, they need to go. The Army community writ large is looking at the ACR and saying, you know, this thing is too expensive, too much equipment, all the command and control stuff. There was a lot of that. And then we came back in October of 2002. We had a Title 10 conference hosted by Shinseki in Washington. It was all the units that were on the tip bid for Iraq. The Army wanted to know what the status is, the training status, the equipment status, all the units that were involved. I came back from that, and that's one of my stories in the presentation here, is because sometimes you go places and you come back and your boss is really pissed off about something that you have no idea what it is. So that's really the greatest ass chewing that I ever got. And that's a story for a different time. And then following that Title 10 conference, Shinseki made personal visits. The Chief of Staff of the Army came to each unit that was on that tip fit just to get their take on it, what their status was, etc. Of course, us having just finished an NTC rotation, we were set to go. Personnel, equipment, everything, training. So Shinseki comes into the headquarters, and Paul Calvert is the 3. He gives them an operational briefing because we had plans for coming out of Jordan, coming out of Turkey, coming out of Kuwait. 3 different options that we presented to the Army. One of the things that came up was, you know, when Shinseki asked, are there any questions? Paul says, yes, sir, I've got one question. Why, if we're going to be on this deployment, are they taking away one of our Apache troops? Shinseki looked, why? What's that? Who's telling you have to do that? The G3 of the Army. Shinseki picks up the phone in my office, calls the G3 and says, stop all of this taking an Apache troop away from the 3rd Cav. They need that. And we did. So we had the 2 Apache troops. When we went to theater, the 4th Squadron of the 3rd ACR had more aircraft than an aviation brigade of 70 aircraft.
That's unbelievable. You know,
2 Apache troops of 8, 3 air cav troops, OH-58 Deltas,
okay.
8 in each of those. And then we had our own medium lift Blackhawks, Stetson. And then we also had the 571st Medevac, 15 aircraft there. So, And then when we were in theater, we got 2 Chinooks from the Iowa National Guard.
Oh, wow.
So we actually had 72 aircraft at one time. And then after Shinseki pulled this miracle and we were able to keep that there, he said, well, you know, I served in the 3rd ACR. I said, oh, yes, sir. I didn't know that. And he said, yeah, I was... I was a regimental adjutant for a while, and then I was 1st Squadron XO, and And so I kind of jokingly, because I had worked for Shinseki for a year from 2001 to 2002. That's another story about the Pentagon on 9/11. So I asked the general, I said, "Sir, were you inducted into the honorary squadron?" He said, "I don't think we even had it then. What is it?" I turned to Paul. I said, "Go get the gauntlets and the saber. We're going to induct the chief of staff of the army into the honorary squadron of the regiment." And so we did that. And Shinseki is, what a great general, what a great soldier. My year with Shinseki and that after 9/11, I mean, we went all over. We spent some time in Uzbekistan as the invasion in northern Afghanistan was going on. Talked with special ops people. We tailhooked onto the Kitty Hawk to talk with 400 Rangers. Shinseki always was inspiration. And you can't work and be with a guy like that for a year without just soaking in so much about soldiering. It's all about that. You know, whenever he wanted to be introduced at a speech or something that he was going to give, it was never the list of, here's the 34th Chief of Staff of the Army, da da da. He just walked up to the mic and said, "My name is Shinseki, and I'm a soldier." That was it. Nothing about his rank or what position he had. He loved and honored being a soldier. And then he promoted me to colonel. And then I left and took over command of the 3rd ACR.
Well, let's, since 2002. We're 2002, that's right, because you went into Iraq in 2003, as you mentioned earlier, during OIF-1. I'd like to transition a little bit, sir, into your time in Iraq, specifically Al Anbar province. And correct me if I'm wrong, it was about a 110 to 120 mile stretch of border between Iraq and Syria that you all were responsible for providing, presumably, security.
Yeah, let me paint the picture here.
Okay.
Because basically, when I got to Kuwait, I got called up by Wallace, who was in Baghdad. He said, "I want you to come up and talk to me about your mission." And so we're getting ready to cross the berm. Wallace calls me forward and he gives me three mission orders. And he wrote them down on the back of a map. Number one, get out to the Syrian border and prevent HVTs from leaving Iraq and foreign fighters from getting in Iraq. Concentrate on the Syrian border. Two, provide security for NGOs moving from Jordan into Baghdad. That's 517 kilometers.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's a tall order right there.
Yeah.
That is a lot of
provide area. Security. He didn't say secure.
Right.
Provide security for elements. And the third thing that he told me, do the right thing.
Ethical imperative.
That was it. Three orders from the Corps commander on what to do with Al Anbar. As we looked at it, Al Anbar had 300 kilometers of Syrian border, 200 kilometers of Jordanian border, 400 kilometers of Saudi border, 900 kilometers of international border that we're responsible for. Al Anbar is the size of Wyoming. Now, he specifically emphasized Syrian border, somewhat to a lesser degree, Jordanian border. One of the things we had to really control that border crossing because of the NGOs. Saudi we left alone for a few months, but there's a big story about a strategic captain that I'll tell in the briefing today. We split up squadrons. One moved out to the Syrian border. One was western, we put in the western sector, which controlled part of the Jordanian highway to a point. But it also took care of the Jordanian border crossing. And there's a lot of stories for that, the border stuff. But then we had a squadron around Ramadi. And Ramadi, that's where the regimental headquarters was set up. And north to about Hit, up past Al-Asad. Now, our aviation squadron and the support squadron were set up at Al-Asad because they did, you know, the job of getting supplies out to the other squadrons. And the maintenance thing was, I can't even believe it. We had such a fantastic maintenance. We had warrant officers that were rebuilding M1 engines in the desert. That's depot level maintenance. Fantastic. Kristen French was a spectacular maintenance Mule Skinner 6. The whole issue of Al Anbar was kind of organizing, you know, how do we get to the understand what the people's needs are? We're certainly finding different elements of foreign fighters in the province, but we really needed the support of the people. And that's a different trick. We pulled in a lot of civil affairs people, a lot of military police, engineer work to help out. We rebuilt the Al Anbar University, which was a women's section. Different things that we did in and around Ramadi. Irrigation was a big deal. The Haditha Dam, which I'll talk about in there. The Haditha Dam was big for all the Western power grid was controlled by that Haditha Dam. And there were only two of the six turbines that were working. And then finding and figuring out who the bad guys are, who is wearing the Sheikh garb one day and the mask of some foreign fighter the next day. A lot of, you know, going to goat grabs, flying out and talking with different sheikhs. We held a provincial meeting for all the tribes, 62 different tribes, and at least 62 different sheikhs. We had more people. I think we had about 80 sheikhs in this meeting. We held it in Ramadi, and this was, I think this was August. They hadn't had any kind of voice in government at all.
Just in your time over there, did you discover who the primary kind of trans-regional threat was? Were you all targeting specific HVTs?
We really were not looking for specific HVTs, you know, although at that time it was the Saddam, we're Saddam thing. But we did have a lot of activity on the Syrian border. Rightfully so, we had night movement. We got support from the Air Force with sensors that they dropped along the border. A lot of other technical things that were aiding us in finding out where people are coming in, because Wallace had left at this time. But, you know, that's when, before he left, one thing that he taught me, commanders, always resource the needs of your subordinates. So, and he knew that I wasn't going to ask for something unless I really needed it. Because that's that trust thing between commander and subordinate, is that you know if your subordinate needs help in some area, you're going to provide the resources for them to accomplish the mission. Wallace taught me that. You know, we had a signal company. He gave me a signal battalion. We needed engineers to help build some things. We got a core wheeled battalion from the South Carolina National Guard. We needed a lot of infantry. We need people on foot in Ramadi because there's, you know, that's just not an armor place. So we had to put infantry in there. He gave us the 124th Infantry Battalion out of the Florida National Guard. We had the Hurricanes. They were infamous in their own way. So we had the task force began to build. So as we built, we were able to actually allocate more of the squadron resources to areas that were more remote, and then that caused us to start looking at the open areas in the desert. So I asked Corps if we could get some LRS, and they were very hesitant to do this until they realized that we had organic and aviation package that can insert and exfil the LRS teams.
Yeah.
So we got Corps and Division LRS. And started using them, and that was the little baby that the regimental three, Paul Calvert. He really got into that stuff and wanted to go on missions with them and everything. And yeah, I had to hold the reins back on him. He was the one who organized the infill and exfil. It was an awesome team that formed up the Task Force Rifles.
As you know, we're transitioning back. Our struck came out in 2024. We're going to go back to being an armored cavalry regiment. So we're going to stand up long knife again. Unfortunately, we won't have those same air assets because I think that's so cool that we had what we did at one point in our history. But we're transitioning. We have transitioned from the GWAT era of being kind of a peacekeeping force where we're conducting offensive, defensive operations, advising the indigenous military forces in Iraq. I'm assuming that we did that in some capacity as well, sir.
Yes, we trained border guards, and that was all part of the big mission on the Saudi border. and also in the northern part of Al Anbar. We trained battalions. We had a province police patrol, like a state patrol organization. We trained them.
GWAT has more or less come to an end for the vast majority of the Army, where we're no longer working in this asymmetric environment, to now at least tactically planning to operate offensively, perhaps defensively, in more of a near peer environment. We've moved, at least currently, we were in CENTCOM region. Now we're moving from being that peacekeeping force to being a rotational force in the Indo-PACOM region, at least for one more rotation in Korea. What are some of the lessons learned, Colonel Teeples, from your experience during the GWAT era that we can still take with us into our time as a rotational force? Because as you know, we have a lot of people, a lot of troopers, young troopers, even some older troopers who have not experienced combat in an ACR. They're just used to that rotational environment. But there's still lessons to be had from our history. What would you say to that, sir?
I think that we were just on the beginning of moving into the digital realm. We had FBCB2, and you know, now that
that's been updated
I looked at a radio that's coming out now that, you know, I mean, you can be behind several hills and still have communication. I mean, that stuff, it's unbelievable. And technology, drone technology, all of those things are enhancing the effectiveness of any unit, really. But the one thing about an armored cavalry regiment that no technology is going to fix or enhance, and that is the trust. The personal relationship that you have. When you see an OH-58 with M4s in the door hover above some enemy that are filling up a weapons depot, and anytime anybody tried to escape, they punch a couple rounds down there just to keep them in their area, and called back, got a ground scout to come out and take care of. But that thing is an operational necessity that you have planned, rehearsed, those kinds of ad hoc little operations that pop up in any kind of scenario. When you have a relationship between somebody who is flying that thing, and I don't know if it's going to be a drone that's being flown, do you sit next to the guy who's flying and say, this is what we're seeing, and then this guy talks to his unit? It's so nice. We used to have the Air Scout team that would come. They'd come to our rock drills, you know, to a squadron rock drill, and walk through where they're going to be, what their call sign is. And they became the brothers of the ground squadrons. I mean, when we were in Iraq, basically, I gave Outlaw to a second squadron and Pegasus to a third squadron. Mm-hmm.
And that was an act of trust to hand those over to be enablers to those ground
squadrons.
Because
the first squadron was out in Al-Qaim on the Syrian border. They needed to have that kind of support right there. Of course, we have a medevac bird out there too.
Sure.
Same thing with down on the Jordanian border. So that kind of relationship, I know we have great technology, much greater than we did 20 years ago. But the thing that I always hold the most dear, that the trust, the individual relationship that you have with a person you're fighting with.
That human component that transcends time and technology, and absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I think that from Vietnam, I mean, just talking with my brothers, their relationship was the guys that they were with at the time. You know, it's like it wasn't so much the unit, because there were different people coming in while, it was individual replacements. It wasn't so much the unit that is trained together back in the States and then comes here. I think that the way you grow up, and I've just described growing up in an ACR, I mean, learning from people, that's really what helped me understand trust. I've got three stories about captains, what I call strategic captains, things that no one would ever consider them being in charge of. That's the thing that the personal piece that I grew up in. I think that was the most important part of being an ACR.
I think there's a lot to be said about tradition and experience. 3CR has both of those. We also have individuals. When I think of some of the true legends of this organization. Everybody gravitates towards Patton, General Dempsey, H.R. McMaster, Richardson. I would also add your name, sir, to the history of individuals who've contributed greatly to this organization, to the traditions, and also through your experience as well. All of you as individuals, and I know that there are countless others, you probably know more than I do. And of course, there are regimental sergeants major as well who have contributed greatly to the history of this organization.
The best soldier that I served with in 36 years of wearing the uniform was the 16th Regimental Command Sergeant Major John Caldwell.
And we have the picture of the two of you, I think, in regimental headquarters. How is the ethos of this organization still affecting young soldiers that come into the Army, that come here today? And what can we learn from this organization to be better soldiers and to be more prepared, I would say, to fight and win our nation's wars going into the future?
A lot of times I talk about teamwork and trust and how do you communicate. The third ACR, any organization, you have to have leaders that empower their subordinates. And more so in a unit that is spread out and responsible for larger missions than they're assigned or doctrinally correct for. So that kind of trust is built being a part of a team. How do you, as a leader in today's Army, build trust, and how do you empower subordinates to do things maybe a little beyond their pay grade? That's the beauty of an armored cavalry regiment and the beauty of a unit with the tradition that they can point to and say, yes, this is how they did it.
There is success in tradition.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear more of your thoughts because that's really what the history of this organization, the traditions, the individuals who have come through here, it's more than just the relationships that I've developed. I was a history major in college, so I came to 3CR and have heard about its campaigns. I'm from New Mexico originally. When I heard about the Battle of Glorieta, and we were on the cusp of planning a staff ride out to Glorieta, I was very excited about that.
Yeah.
Do you believe that the history and the traditions of this organization still have an impact in the lives of troopers today?
I do.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. You know, the 74th took us up to Rosebud, and I've been to Rosebud as a squadron commander. We did it on horseback. But when we did the mounted portion at the Little Bighorn, and we had that Leavenworth instructor came out, one of the things that I never knew is that the Rosebud happened 2 weeks before the Little Bighorn. And they should have used that. Of course, they couldn't because the communications weren't allowed.
Right.
To inform the 7th Cavalry that this was the first time at the Rosebud the enemy had attacked them. It was always us attacking. Had the 7th, if they would have had that information, they might have went towards the small village a little bit different.
Those are the types of stories that we don't hear about. We don't think about unless we're really digging deep into the history of the organization.
I tell you, Johnny Richardson knows how to dig deep into
that. He does, sir. Yes. And I've seen him explain things in ways that nobody else has explained things. Yeah. So it is my hope and my prayer that for even 100 years from now, that the history of this organization from 1846 until now, but even the next 100 years are still, there is still someone who is picking up the baton and carrying the history of this organization because it is fascinating and just incredible to be in the presence of some of these individuals like yourself, sir, who have served in 3CR. So any closing thoughts?
I have to tell you that another very important part of being a leader is having a good chaplain.
Agreed.
Thank you for your professionalism.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Colonel Teeples, thank you for joining us on Legends Among Us this week. It's been an honor to sit with you for a little bit and chat, and I'm looking forward to your LPD here in a little bit. But with that being said, we'll call it good, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, that was Colonel Retired David Teeples, the 70th Regimental Commander of 3CR. just great to have him on the show, especially this week during Brave Rifles Week, which we are wrapping up. If you listened to the show and were inspired by what you heard, please leave some comments, leave a thumbs up, pass on the link to this podcast. I do believe this is going to be my last episode because I'm about to PCS in a few weeks, and the Sabre Chaplain, Chaplain Matthew Trammell, will be picking up the reins going into the future. So great to be with you for this last year, and we will catch up down the road.